Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Brian Emerson, 38876. I'm counsel for the appellant, Jeremy Martin. Mr. Martin has raised just two issues in his opening brief, the first concerning his initial contact with police, and the second concerning his right to testify. While I believe both issues are meritorious, I want to devote most, if not all, of my time to discussing the second issue. The parties agree, I believe, that this second issue appears to be an issue of first impression in Colorado, and it's an important one because it implicates Mr. Martin's fundamental right to testify. I want to briefly talk about the facts of the case and the procedure of the case, and I'll get right into the law with a particular focus on a case that I briefed, U.S. v. Walker, which is a Fifth Circuit case that is factually very similar to this case, and it also sets forth a very useful test that I'm asking this court to adopt because we don't have a similar test in Colorado. So I'll jump right into the issue that we're addressing today that I raised, and the question is, when and under what circumstances should a trial court allow a criminal defendant to reopen the evidence in his case so that he can testify after he initially opted not to do so? The facts of this case are mostly not in dispute. They're briefed in detail by both parties. I'm not going to go into those. I'll just remind the court that this is the 7-Eleven bathroom case. There was a dispute outside of the bathroom about Mr. Martin being in that bathroom too long and an altercation with the police. And I want to just move right into the trial procedure because that's really what's important. At trial, after the prosecution rested, Mr. Martin was trying to determine whether he was going to testify, and he asked for time to consider that with his attorney. Ultimately, he decided not to do that. The defense then called a couple witnesses and was going to call a third witness, who was a doctor who was going to testify about the extent of his injuries. For some reason, it's not clear on the record, that party, that doctor, did not show up. And defense counsel came in and said, well, he's not here, we're just going to rest. So the defense did rest. The prosecution did not call any rebuttal witnesses. And at about 11:15, this is on a Thursday, trial was set through Friday, the jury went out for an hour and 45-minute recess and lunch. During that period, the parties discussed the jury instructions. The defense requested and received a self-defense instruction. And then at 1 o'clock, before the jury was brought back in, Mr. Martin indicated he wanted to testify, that he at this point wanted to change his mind and testify. And the court basically said, well, we've already closed the evidence. Why should you be allowed to testify? What's your reason? And Mr. Martin said, well, I thought my witness was coming. I thought the doctor was going to be there, and the doctor didn't show up. And he also explicitly said, I want to tell the jury about my mental state at the time and what happened, what I remember happened. He wanted to tell his story, basically, to the jury. The court then asked for an offer of proof, and defense counsel, for reasons unknown to me, sat in his hands and said, I'm not going to give an offer of proof. I call all my witnesses. So Mr. Martin was essentially abandoned at that point, and he offered up his own offer of proof, which was something to the effect that I want to introduce evidence about the officers and their prior misconduct and use of excessive force. The court said, well, that's probably not going to be inadmissible, and then very shortly thereafter just denied the motion, and ultimately he was not able to testify. Those are the facts that I want to draw attention to. I think those are what's relevant in this case. If we look at the standard here in Colorado, there's not a lot of case law on this. And the standard is a discretionary one, but the Colorado cases don't provide any guidance for how to exercise that discretion. That's the reason I'm looking to U.S. v. Walker. It's this Fifth Circuit case. Let me give the site. It is in the briefs. It's 772 F. 2nd 1172, which is Fifth Circuit 1985. And I'm urging the court to accept this standard. It's a four-part test. And the reason is it's straightforward yet detailed at the same time. It's nuanced, and I think it's a principled approach to determine at what point do we honor someone's right to testify. So I want to talk very briefly about the Walker facts so you understand how it compares to this case. Walker factually, the actual facts of the case are not important. The procedure, trial ended on a Thursday there, the prosecution rested on a Thursday, the defense presented its case on a Friday. Similarly, the defendant decided not to testify. His reason was he was nervous and too emotional. Defense rested. That's a Friday, they go to the weekend. Monday morning, they change their mind and they reopen the evidence for the specific purpose of hearing the defendant's testimony.
Counsel, yes. In Walker, did they have a procedure like we have in Colorado, a Curtis advisement, as well as an elicitation on the record that the defendant does or does not want to testify?
That's a good question. I actually don't have an answer for you, Your Honor. There was some discussion about when Walker did leave, he similarly consulted with counsel about whether he would do that. He then came in, and the court did inquire on what he was going to do. I don't think the case specifically says that he was advised, and it certainly didn't name Curtis, obviously, but I don't recall that there was anything like that.
Mr. Emerson?
Yes.
If we were to adopt the Walker test, do we have to send it back for findings?
I don't think so, and I'll get into that right now. I'm going to go through the four Walker tests, some of them briefly, because I don't think we need to talk about them that much. But The court did not make, in this case, much of findings. Basically, I think it narrowly focused on the fact that that offer of proof that he made about the cops and their prior misconduct. Mr. Martin made other comments about what he wanted to testify. When he was first asked about it, he specifically said, I do want to talk about what my mental state was. I want to talk about what I remember about happening. I want to tell my version of the story. I think, this is almost a direct quote, the jury would help the jury hear what I have to say. So, but the trial court didn't really mention that or talk about that. I think it was narrowly focused on this offer of proof. And I remind the court that during that offer of proof, Mr. Martin was alone. He had been abandoned by his counsel. That's another issue. We're not raising that in the brief here, but I think it's important for the court to understand that all of a sudden, for the first time, he is his own voice box. He has to represent on the spot in a criminal trial what he's going to testify to. And he didn't speak particularly well there, but he'd already done so. So moving quickly to the Walker test, timeliness is the first factor in the Walker test. I'm not going to go into that as brief. There was longer delays in both Walker and a companion case in the Eighth Circuit, which is U.S. v. Larson. It's in the briefs. They called the delay there minimal under all circumstances. Here we had a couple hour delay, and the delay was mostly the lunch recess for the jury. That was going to happen anyway. So we have a very, very minimal delay in this case.
How does the fact that the defendant was allowed to address the court on two prior occasions, how's that factor into the Walker factors?
It's not explicitly addressed in any way. Are you referring to the fact that he was given an opportunity to express himself?
I'm referring to the fact that they had the Curtis advisement, and then at the end of the case, he actually addressed the court saying, okay, I've talked to counsel, and we don't see any need to put any further evidence on.
Well, I'm not sure it does, but the Walker test focuses on the timeliness and the character of the evidence, and it focuses on some other things, but I can address that. It goes to the final factor, and I'll just jump to that one since Your Honor mentioned that one. The final factor discusses the reasonableness of the request to reopen. And so what happened here was, as you alluded to, there was some discussion. He did waive his right under Curtis. There's no dispute to that. The question is, what happens later after the waiver? Can he then revoke that waiver in essence? And we have plenty of case law in this state that allows you to revoke the waiver. It is discretionary, but it happens all the time under the Sixth Amendment. I do ADC cases. I can't tell you how many times I see the defendant waives his right to counsel and either get the public defender reappointed or an ADC counsel appointed. And that's really, it's favorable for the court, it's favorable for all the parties involved because pro se litigation is difficult and can be messy. So I think there's an advantage to that. But to more directly address your question, I don't think we can expect a person like this, a young man like Mr. Martin, to automatically appreciate losing a witness that he had, okay? He was told by his counsel, as he said to the court, my counsel said this was an important witness. In fact, the counsel told him it was his key witness. So all of a sudden, the key witness is gone, and there he is. And he says, okay, let's go on. But if you remember in the record, he immediately asks about the video of the incident. And he wants to make sure that the jury will be able to see the video and also see all the angles of the video. And they apparently can zoom in and get different angles of the video. I think his wheels are turning there. I'm speculating, of course, but he's wondering, what's my evidence now? The doctor's not here. What's going to happen? And so he ruminates over the next 2-3 hours. That's not that long a period of time. He realizes the doctor's not there. I was told he was going to be there. This is a significant witness. Now what am I? And then he decides he wants to testify. There's nothing in between. There's no delay in between that's substantial. There was no jury instructions.
What was the doctor supposed to testify to?
He was going to testify about presumably the significance of the injuries. And this was a self-defense case, of course. He was significantly injured. He was tased, it's in the brief, 18 times to his genitals, to his scrotum. He was beaten bloody with fists, elbows, knees. He was in the hospital for 3 or 4 days, coma, seizures, all kinds of stuff. And so that was going to go directly to the severity of the police response. And this is a pretty minor case, all in all, for the kind of injuries he received. Now, that's another issue entirely, but that's what the doctor was going to be testifying about, the significance of the injuries he received. So if you look at the reasonableness of his request, I don't think it's unreasonable at all. The Walker court looked at the reasons that what Mr. Walker gave. Those reasons were, I'm too emotional, I'm too nervous. They found that that wasn't unreasonable. Another case, U.S. v. Parker, it's a Fifth Circuit case. That is 73F3rd 48. I don't know if I mentioned that in the brief. Their defense counsel forgot to impeach the only eyewitness in the case with a prior statement. And the court there said, well, defense counsel said he made a mistake. That's not unreasonable either. So if those weren't unreasonable, then losing a witness that you were relying on, and whether we think that was a witness was going to provide great testimony for him in this case, he believed that. He was told he was going to.
But he makes a conscious statement to the trial court saying, yeah, I'm aware that this witness is not going to be here, and it's okay, and we're done.
Right.
And now, you know, it's not like this is his first time to address the court with respect to that missing witness. He's addressed the court once before with respect to that witness.
I'm not sure that, I don't remember that specifically. I believe that the witness comes in, counsel comes in, says the witness isn't going to be here, and then they rest. And then at that moment, he decides, it's from then that he talks about the video. I don't recall he had another opportunity to come in. I believe that's when they recess for an hour and 45 minutes. Now, if Your Honor is certain about that, then I will defer to the court. I don't remember that's the way the facts proceeding. But even if it was that was the case, I'm not sure that is the end all and be all of this case. I guess what we're saying then is that a defendant can't change his mind in a very short period of time. Again, we're not dealing with days, we're dealing with a matter of an hour, where he has a chance to think about the ramifications to his defense of losing his witness. To expect him to understand that immediately, I don't think that we can put that on him. And especially, again, I have to emphasize this, when his attorney told him that this was a key witness. This was a witness that the defense did not decide not to call. There's some indication later on the counsel says that. That is not the case. If you look at the point where it happens, the witness is not there.
Was there any dispute about the injuries?
I don't think there, no, there's not a dispute about the injuries necessarily, but there is a dispute about the reasonableness of the conduct. There is a dispute.
How could the doctor have testified about the reasonableness of the officer's conduct?
Well, I certainly think that the injuries reflect, and severity of the injuries reflect the reasonableness of the situation, the response by the police.
Was there a dispute about the severity of the injuries?
Not about the severity of the injury. There was not a dispute about the severity of the injuries explicitly. However, there hadn't been a lot of testimony about the extent of the injuries. And the doctor was the doctor who treated him in the hospital, and that doctor was going to come in and talk specifically about it. Paramedic was called, the paramedic testified a little about that, but the doctor was really going to be the key witness who was going to come in and say, look, this guy received a significant beating. And there's pictures in the record, if Your Honors want to take a look at them. Apart from, they're bad. He looks very bad, and it's another decision altogether about how the police acted in this case, but he did receive a significant beating.
Mr. Emerson, can I ask you a question?
Absolutely.
My recollection is there's something in the record about Mr. Martin possibly not being competent at one point in time?
I believe that was early on in the case, if I remember correctly. I don't recall that explicitly.
Is that reflected at all in his perceptions of how the case was going, or he misunderstood anything about the case?
Well, I can't comment on that. I think that's an excellent question. I think during the trial procedure, there was no indication that he was not understanding things. He did have the opportunity to talk about this decision with counsel. It's clear, though, that they were contemplating whether he was going to testify. This was not, in a lot of cases, it's a done deal, right? The case proceeds, and everyone knows that the defendant is not going to testify, at least on the defense side. This was not the case. They were contemplating it. When they talked to the court and asked for a recess to go talk about the situation, the court asked defense counsel how many witnesses. He brought two or three, depending on whether Mr. Martin testifies. This was still up in the air. And when he comes back in, he says, I'm not going to testify on advice of counsel. He sounds like he wants to, but he's taking the advice of counsel. He did have a prior felony, so it's a difficult decision for him. But this was an ongoing process that they were going through. And it's a self-defense case. So typically, a defendant testifies in a self-defense case. The jury is very important for the jury to hear about the mental state, about the reasonableness of the conduct. They have to decide reasonableness. And one of the things they need to do, generally, or one of the things that's most helpful, I should say, is to hear directly from the defendant.
Mr. Emerson, yes. As I understand it, the prosecution claimed that it had released one of the officers who was a possible rebuttal witness.
Yes.
And thereby would have been prejudiced if the court allowed the evidence to be reopened.
Yes.
Are there any findings on that issue that we could look at? Or if not, what are we supposed to do with that assertion?
I can address that very, very directly, actually. There are no findings. One witness was mentioned, a detective. Detective Ross was a detective involved in the incident. He wasn't a detective at the time. He later became a detective. The advisory witness was also a detective. It's referenced to one of those two people. The cases, again, Larson and Walker, it doesn't matter that they were unavailable. Those cases find out if there's no showing by the prosecution in the trial court, that they are unavailable. We're not going to speculate that they're unavailable. In this case, these are both Englewood officers. They work in Englewood. They presumably live in somewhere in the metro area. They're not in Wyoming. They understood the trial was going to be through Friday. The advisor was certainly on call through then. Detective Ross was close by, too. There's no indication at all that those officers couldn't be back in a two-hour, three-hour delay. You don't have to go back for findings on that. Walker and Larson and some other cases as well make it clear that it really is the burden on the prosecution to say, hey, we can't get these guys. In the Larson case, they are witnesses in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and there they said they all live there. No, there's no showing that they can't be there, and we're just not going to make that finding. So I don't think you have to any more findings. I think the prejudice is a non-issue. I think I'm out of time, so I'll end with that. Unless there's any further questions. So I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Catherine Hansen, registration number 25464, appearing on behalf of the people in this matter. I'd like to talk a little bit about the context in which this issue arose, because I think it's important to bring up a few facts that weren't mentioned. And because this is an abuse of discretion standard, I think it's important that you understand that the court was looking at everything it had in front of it. Certainly the Walker factors were not discussed, that case, nor the specific test was issued. So the court was basically looking at all of what it had in front of it. And what it had in front of it was, first of all, a case that has been delayed almost 4 years. As I think the defendant discusses in his opening brief, there were substantial delays before trial involving entries of pleas, withdrawal of pleas, one point, withdrawal of plea at the sentencing, which required the case to basically be started over. There were numerous changes of attorneys. There were numerous continuances. And I didn't go through to see exactly which is attributed to which, but certainly there was quite a bit of back and forth before the case even got to trial. And then when we get to trial, the prosecution rested after presenting their evidence, and a recess was given to allow the defendant time to consider whether to testify. After that recess, he came back and indicated, following a full courtesy advisement, that he had decided not to testify. He didn't give any reasons, didn't give any explanation, just chose not to testify.
That was at the beginning of the defense case?
Yes. And so basically what you have, and we're not certainly relying solely on that, what you have then is the presentation of the defense case, which is two witnesses. And then the defense counsel indicated that he wanted to go out and speak to his third witness. And presumably this was the doctor. He went out and spoke with the witness, or we think he spoke with her. So we just don't know. Because when he came back in, what he said was, I don't have my witness. He did not indicate that the witness was not there. He said, I don't have my witness. I'm choosing not to call him. The use of those words, I'm choosing not to call him, that indicates that there was a choice there. So there's nothing in the record whatsoever that indicates that they could not call him, that they were making their decision based on the doctor's absence. And in fact,
that was counsel that said that?
That was counsel. So then the court says, okay, are you going to rest at this point? And the defense counsel says, yes. And then there was a discussion between defense counsel and the defendant, clearly off the record, but it is reflected in the record. The parties went back on the record, and the court indicated, apparently they had indicated to the court that Mr. Martin, the defendant, wanted to make a statement to the court. The court advised him, you know, you understand you have counsel, anything you say can be used against you, basically kind of be careful. And then the defendant made the specific statement, I have no more witnesses to call on my behalf. We both decided the doctor may not help our case and could possibly only hurt our case. We decided we're not going to call any more witnesses. I think that is critical, because at that point, he knows that the doctor is not going to be called as a witness, whether it's because the doctor is not there or whether it's because the defense counsel spoke to the doctor. And I think there's an indication that they spoke to the doctor and determined that he would not help the case. But we don't have to speculate at this point why the defendant is choosing not to testify, because he thinks the doctor is going to testify. At this point, he knows the doctor is not going to testify. He tells the court He's not going to testify because essentially he won't help us and he might hurt us. And therefore, we have no further witnesses, including himself. He makes no indication at this point that he wants to testify because of the absence of this other evidence. And so that was a factor that the court considered. And even if we apply the Walker factors, which I'll talk about that in just a minute, certainly that is a factor that the court has considered, the reason for the change, the reason for not presenting the evidence before, why he needs to reopen the case.
Is that your strongest argument, that there wasn't a good reason,
no,
as opposed to the other factors?
No, I think what the court relied most heavily on, and I think this is significant, is the lack of any indication of the nature of the testimony and that it would have been admissible, relevant, and helpful. And briefly, going back to the Walker test, I would urge this court not to adopt the Walker test. And the reasoning is not because I think the factors are inappropriate. I certainly think the factors are appropriate things to consider, and I don't have a problem. I know some other circuit courts have cited this case for one factor or another. Some have cited the whole test. But I think when you put forth a four-factor test such as this, you get the impression that these are exclusive considerations. And even if you phrase it as these are the four relevant factors, but this is not an exhaustive list, I think parties and courts have a tendency to emphasize those factors over all other. And because there's no question here, this is an abuse of discretion standard. And when we're asking whether the court exercises discretion properly, we want to look at all of the information that was in front of that court. And so while I would urge, I don't have a problem with consideration of those factors, and I essentially think that the court considered those factors in ruling on this. The court asked the proper questions. I certainly don't think that this is...
Well, the court mentioned the 2.5 hours difference.
Correct.
But it didn't say anything about that length being determinative one way or the other.
And that's part of the problem with having a four-factor test, is it kind of puts on the court the idea that, okay, these are the things that you have to look at, and these are the things that, you know, there will be some argument whether it has to be findings one way or the other. How much does the court have to explain the balancing is, you know, and certainly these are relevant factors, but in some cases something might be more important than others.
Well, don't we do that all the time? We review what trial courts do for abuse of discretion.
Absolutely.
And so, I mean, how hard is it for a court to look at four factors and say, 1, 2, 3, 4, here's how I determine the issues on these four factors?
And I don't have a problem with consideration of these factors. What we have a problem with is the idea that it should be a four-factor test that should be set forth for the trial courts, because I do believe that that emphasizes those four factors and gives the impression that this is an exhaustive list. And I can tell you as an appellate attorney, I've done numerous cases where I've seen, even where there's a multi-factor test listed and there's a kind of a qualifying statement, this is not an exhaustive list, substantial litigation gets focused on those factors. So again, I have no problem with consideration of those factors. I think the court considered them.
How do we come up with 2.5 hours? As I understand it, we broke at 11:15, they convened at 12:45, and somewhere right after that. That looks like an hour and a half or an hour and three quarters.
I think what the court may have been referring to is when he initially waived his right to testify, because he waived his right to testify before they put on the defense witnesses. So my guess is it was the difference in the change of his decision.
I would, were those witnesses like 5 minutes each?
I think they were fairly brief. I read through the testimony and I don't believe that they were lengthy. So, and I think he said about 2.5 hours. Certainly this is not a significant period of time. In Walker they talk about even any delay kind of weighs against them, just not particularly heavily. And I think the court didn't rely on that heavily. I think the court noted it. In fact, the court seemed to rely mostly, and I guess this would be an interpretation of the court's ruling, that it found the following two factors the most significant and therefore guided its decision, which is the reason for the defendant's stated reason for the change of heart, which was just refuted by the record, and the defendant's failure to articulate that reopening the testimony would be necessary to produce relevant, helpful testimony.
When he says, "I want to explain my actions or my culpable mental state," wouldn't that be relevant?
Well, we don't know because he doesn't give any specifics. And when the court asked him, "Give me some specifics. Let me know what you're talking about," the defendant only referred to the internal affairs issues.
Ms. Hudson, what would have been the harm for the trial court to allow him to testify? There hadn't been instructions hadn't been given, is that right, at that point, to the jury?
Not to the jury.
No closing arguments?
Correct.
What would have been the harm?
Well, I think you can say that in a lot of these cases, especially when the delay is short. You know, what's the big deal? Why shouldn't he have been able to testify? And I think what you have to do is look at the totality of the circumstances facing the court. And we had a substantial delay before trial. We have a defendant getting a Curtis advisement, making a valid waiver. And then the defendant, 2.5 years after witnesses had been released, after jury instructions had already been finalized, and the defendant saying, "I changed my mind." And the court clearly considered it. The court clearly was willing to entertain the notion. But, I mean, even though the court didn't rely on the factors, the court actually did what it was supposed to do and consider all the totality of the circumstances and the factors, and those just simply did not weigh in his favor.
Where did the court consider his testimony or his statements about he wanted to say about his state of mind and his actions? I understand the court dealt with the evidence issue of the officers pretty clearly, said it wouldn't be admissible. Court said nothing about Mr. Martin's proposed testimony about his actions or state of mind.
Well, I think that, first of all, you look at the progression of the discussion. The court asked him, what are you going to want to talk about? What evidence do you want to present? The defendant made general statements. The court said, again, "I'm struggling. Why do we need to reopen this case, and what do you want to talk about?"
Well, the court said, "I'm already going to give the self-defense instruction," right?
Correct.
That was one of its rationales. But it didn't talk about, his state of mind, whether he would be entitled to talk further about the reasons for his fear that he was being subjected to unreasonable force.
Because the defendant didn't provide any offer of proof whatsoever. And it's unlike Walker, where they acknowledged in Walker that the failure to provide some sort of offer of proof or indication about what the defendant would say would normally weigh very heavily against him. And the court didn't in that case because, first of all, the court didn't inquire. No one asked him, "What were you going to say?" Which we have here. Also in Walker,
wasn't it pretty obvious that if he was allowed to testify, he would get up there and say, "I didn't fight with the officers, they beat me"? I mean, isn't it pretty obvious that that would be the tenor of his testimony?
We don't know. I mean, we have a man here who obviously has, or from his behavior, has some issues. We don't know if he would get up there and say, you know, "These officers weren't asking for it." We don't know. He was given multiple opportunities to give at least an offer of proof as to what he would say. And Walker talks about the fact that it not only has to be admissible, it has to be helpful.
Do you agree with Mr. Emerson's characterization that the defendant was abandoned by his counsel at that point?
No. I think defense counsel was asked a direct question by the court, and as an officer of the court, he told the court, "I can't speak to exactly what the defendant is going to testify to. He would be better to speak to," or he didn't say that. He said, "The defendant would be better to speak to exactly what he's going to testify to. I can tell you I have put on the witnesses I determined would be helpful." So counsel had that discussion and then basically turned it over to the defendant to make the offer of proof, and the defendant clearly had no concerns about speaking to the court. The court had told him he had no problems with that. And so I don't think he was abandoned. At no point did he ask for counsel's help with this. Counsel was right there, and all he really did was say, "I can't speak to exactly what he wants to say." And the defendant was given multiple opportunities by the court to give an offer of proof. So basically what we would be saying is that if the character of the testimony is important and the nature of the testimony is important, and Walker tells us that it needs to be relevant, admissible, and helpful, the defendant merely saying, "I want them to hear my side of the story," which is essentially all he said, is just not sufficient for the trial court to exercise its discretion and say, yes, it's it's appropriate to open to the additional admissible evidence.
It's a little different, I think, because I want them to hear my side of the story, and that is these cops have these past problems. It's a little different than when a guy says, I wanted them to hear my side of the story and my mental state.
But that's still general vague assertions.
By the criminal defendant himself.
Correct.
Yeah.
So he could get up there and say, I was angry. I was mad at them because they called me out of the bathroom. You know, there was some evidence that he had said bad things. And if that's all he said, that wouldn't be helpful to him.
You know what? I think that would be his choice, wouldn't it? To testify to whether it be helpful or not.
But that's a factor. We're not dealing with the right to testify. If we were dealing with the right to testify, that would not be a factor. But if we're going to consider these factors, and numerous cases, so these are relevant factors, and I think they are relevant factors, whether evidence is helpful to the defense is a relevant consideration. And the defendant provided no specific information whatsoever that anything he said would be helpful to him. All he said is, I want to testify about my version of the facts and my mental state.
Do each of the cases cited by the defense brief, do they have long, detailed, and specific offers of proof?
No, in fact, Walker had none. And they, as I said, they indicated that would normally be held heavily against him. But they chose not to because of the fact that no one asked him, because of the fact that he would testify about his own version of statements. And basically, I think in Walker, it was an issue of whether he was even there, you know, that kind of thing. And I'm not exactly sure, but if you look on, and I see I'm out of time, but if you look on page 6 of the Walker opinion, it describes why the offer of proof, the lack of offer of proof, isn't fatal there. It should be here.
May I ask one more question? I think the defendant cited several cases applying the Walker factors. Are there not that many cases applying the Walker factors throughout in the state courts?
Well, I looked at both Larson and Walker, because Larson was actually first. There are a few federal circuits, the 2nd, the 6th, there's multiple circuits. Some of them cite the four factors. Some of them...
How about state courts? Anybody in the
state
courts?
I did not see any.
Okay, thank you.
I did not see any.
Thank you both for your arguments this afternoon. This case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course.
Thank you.